You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Cheryl Wassenaar. Cheryl, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk about your work. I know you're calling from St. Louis. I'd love to know just a little bit about what it's like in St. Louis for artists. How do you find it? How do you find the city in terms of, let's say, supporting artists or artist communities?
You know, I've been in St. Louis since 2001, and I've seen the city change and grow a lot in respect to its support of artists. When I first came, there was a lot of really sort of high-end, sort of top-tier institutions, the Contemporary Art Museum, our St. Louis Art Museum, Pulitzer Museum. But since that time, there's been a lot of kind of grassroots organizations that have started up that really support artists at different levels. A lot of emerging work and a lot of work that socially engaged practices. So it just seems like it's a much more vibrant city relative to the art and to the artists that live there. I think it's really coming into its own.
That's good to hear. So let's talk about your work. What are you working on at the moment, or could be recently completed? I know you're probably working on more than one thing.
Yeah, I'm working on an exhibition that will open here in St. Louis in early September. And it's an exhibition called The Cabinet of Ordinary Affairs. And it's my third collaboration with Stephanie Schlafer, who is an artist and a poet, who also lives here in St. Louis. We've done a couple of projects together that have used her poetry as a point of departure in our work. So every work that we do together has a different sensibility, just depending on the nature of the set of poems that we're working from. So this particular...
So let's talk about, how you guys work together on this particular show and how it came together. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I think the nature of our collaborations have grown a bit more ambitious in scale and in scope, and probably just in how we work together, how we collaborate together. Before, we had fairly defined roles in our work together. So she was the poet, she wrote the poems, and I would visually reinterpret the poems, typically using vinyl lettering that would kind of run through gallery spaces on walls and windows and things like that. This particular one is based on a group of her poems called The Cabinet Ministers, and it imagines the brain as a collection of governing bodies that act as a bureaucratic institution. So you have different ministers that preside over different functions of the brain, like the cabinet minister of desire or indulgence or reason, confrontation, things like that. So the poem and installation will work with this idea of having these distinct inner voices that all compete for attention and persuasion. So we're still working this out, but you asked about how we're working together. We're actually working through all the ideation process together, right from the beginning. She's coming at this with her background as a sculptor and as a poet. I think what I sort of bring to the table is someone who has a designerly orientation. I work a lot with topography and with color. And so I sort of have my background as sensibilities as a painter, but I'm really interested in using objects that are part of our everyday culture. So really interested in sort of the associations of everyday objects and manipulating those too. So we've found this intersection in our love for language and how we can use writing as a framework, something to sort of push against in our own artistic practices. So we're meeting regularly. We have a Google Doc that we sort of brainstorm all of these different possibilities, and we sort of kind of work to sort of hone in on ideas that really resonate with us collectively. And that's just a really different way of working for me. I kind of come from a practice that's been pretty traditional and sort of working by myself in my own studio. So this has been really a way to expand kind of my own thinking and kind of rub up against different kinds of making and different technologies and different practices that I probably wouldn't ordinarily get into.
That's so interesting to think of, collaboration that way. And I'd love to ask you more about that collaborative process, because, right, as a as an artist, as a painter who's worked in your studio, so many artists are used to this kind of this way of working with time, this way of working alone mostly, that's so completely different than collaborating. I know you've worked with her before and built shows together. When you collaborate, is it particularly challenging? Is it that you guys both relate to each other and work well? Or is it also kind of challenging because as compared to your past, you're not entirely in control of everything. Right.
Right. I think my work has always dealt with some given parameters. I've always worked with found material. So I love this idea of working up against a set of constraints and a set of conditions. And so in some ways, collaborating is sort of another set of conditions, a set of parameters that you have to sort of negotiate with. I don't think I could collaborate with just anyone. I think that she's somebody that I respect highly. I respect her working process, and I respect the way that she deals with language. And she's, like I said, we are coming at this from different points of views and almost different disciplines and different kinds of training. And we've just found this really interesting space of overlap. And to date, our realms of sort of what we've been in charge of have been fairly distinct. I guess I'll talk a little bit about the Cleavemark Drive project, because that was our second collaboration and one that was much more immersive in terms of the installation itself and the way that we work together.
Okay, yeah, let's hear more about that. Yeah, how that one came together, Cleavemark, and how that came about.
So she had written a set of poems. It's actually a published book called Cleavemark, and it was a poem that talk about the loss of her grandmother when she was young. So she was remembering her grandmother by remembering and reconstructing her house, her domestic space. So we used a combination of text from the poems and sculpture and sound and scent to think about a really tactile and sensory experience for the viewer, to sort of trigger this sense of nostalgia and childhood and memory and a sense of loss. So I would, she sent me the manuscript for the poems, and I went through them very carefully. And oddly enough, I didn't really ask her about the poems. I tried not to just have her tell me what she was thinking. I really tried to do that work myself, go through the poems and really kind of get to know them in my own way, and pick out certain passages that really resonated with me and try to form a collection of almost sound bites from different poems and start to think about those poems in relationship to the space that we were installing in the gallery space. So in that sense, because the poems were about a domestic space, different poems had different sort of connotations of it being like the kitchen space or like a space for conversation versus a space that was kind of a night space or maybe a bedroom space. So I kind of started plotting the language, mapping it through the gallery space, kind of where I felt that it fit. And then after that, we sort of started to assign color and texture to that. Trying to think about how the light in the space would work and what poems sort of fit the idea of a dark, cloistered space. And I worked that part out a little bit in terms of visually arranging some vinyl lettering on the wall and thinking about sound and thinking about density. And then she worked on sculptural elements that would act as, I guess if you would think about the poems and the language on the wall as kind of narrative context that add more imagery, more sound, more kind of emotional tenor than the sculptures or sort of the objects in the room or the objects in the space. So she would think about objects that were referenced in the poems or objects that she remembered from her grandmother's house and what kind of domestic materials would make sense in relationship to those. Materials like raw materials like salt and sugar, soap, things that you would use in a domestic space to preserve or to contain or to embed. And she would use that as a kind of a driving metaphor for how she would manipulate these domestic objects that we would place around the space. We used things like sound from the poems. The poems were so evocative in terms of their imagery. And so it was pretty, in a sense, it was easy. I would say she's a great person to collaborate with because she gives me so much material to work with. The poems offer up so much that, in a sense, we're just sort of extracting from those and sort of pulling apart some of the language and the images, which is already so evocative, and just putting that in a slightly different, like visualizing it or translating language to sound or translating language to a scent or trying to, you know, put different sensory experiences and translate them, in a sense, into different ways that people aren't used to seeing them.
And that must be exciting for your collaborator as well. That's such a different way for a poet or writer to see their work or to talk about their work, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think it has been interesting for her. She's a visual person as well, so when she creates and composes on a page, there is a kind of visual quality to the way that she places the words, thinking about visual spaces in terms of pause or length of breath, things like that. So there's a visual quality already, but I sort of take it to another level and really think about it in terms of the associations that a particular font could give it, or scale, the density of layering. I guess for one example, there was a poem that started to talk about an aerial perspective of the house and describing it sort of from the outside and looking at its systems and its circuitry. And so I arranged that poem kind of line by line, almost like a electrical plan, sort of looking at, it almost has a mechanical kind of quality where you follow certain lines of the poems and they sort of weave up and down and throughout and kind of create a kind of circuitry board that might be like a something that you would find in a sort of an electrical plan.
Right.
So she had never thought about the poem like that when she was writing it. But when she saw it, it really connected and it made a lot of sense to her.
And so there's an installation, there's objects being created. Or because you worked on the installation together, do both of you own the objects as well, that you both possess them? I mean, you're building a show together, and I'm kind of asking that to wonder how then they move into collections, and is it under both of your names, or how does that work?
We haven't had that problem yet. I sort of look forward to these pieces. You know, right now the installations are so site specific, and they're designed to really work as a whole experience. So the idea of certain objects kind of living independently of that is not something that we've really explored or had to deal with quite yet. The Cleve Mark show, she did most of the sculptural work. This show that we're doing now, The Cabinet of Ordinary Stairs, I think is going to be, we're going to be working on the fabrication, the objects, the sound pieces all together. So it's kind of a step further into kind of working as one rather than as sort of two people who are sort of working around and about the same thing. I think it's going to be much more of a shared experience. So I'm not quite sure how we'll deal with the naming of things. I think right now it would make sense for us to sort of put our names together on all of it.
And so much of this work, I mean, Ed, comes from, of course, your background and your past. And are you still producing paintings in the studio yourself and doing other work than what you're doing collaboratively?
I am. I do have a series of objects that are kind of hybrids of probably design, painting, and sculpture. that are made out of found and kind of repurposed commercial signage. Like I said, I have a background in painting, but I've always been interested in the idea of building a painting rather than painting a painting. So in graduate school, I did a lot of work that dealt with the wall as the plane and really gathered a lot of found material and found objects to sort of construct these compositions, these sort of wall compositions. And in that process of gathering material, found material, I came across the commercial sign that had been sort of quartered. So there was spliced language. It was, you know, type letter forms that were sort of not whole, but kind of partial forms. And for some reason, that really resonated with me. Like it, my interest in graphic design, my interest in language and typographic form, my interest in dealing with objects that sort of live out in the world as functional things rather than as aesthetic objects, and working with the parameters of those things.
Well, typography seems to come forward so much in that work, or the work that I've seen of yours. It seems to play such a prominent role and such an active role in terms of I guess you could say, you know, as you said, your background in graphic design, but the letter forms themselves seem to kind of animate the whole work, which is really interesting. It's hard to do. I remember once a typographer, or when I was in school, someone who was interested in typography saying it's very hard for letters to stand on their own without there being some kind of meaning ascribed to them. But in your works, it seems like that was happening, right? The letter forms, the typographical and graphic interest you have, we're using them almost as objects or forms or colors or shapes, as opposed to their meaning or what they might mean together. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's almost, you know, I don't have any formal training in typography. My training was always in visual art and painting, I guess, initially. So in a sense, I didn't have those preconceived notions as a typographer might have in terms of using the font, using the typographic choices specifically to support an intended meaning. I was almost dismantling that by taking, again, very functional sort of generic language and by rearranging and by sort of fracturing the language, it was more an interest in finding the poetic qualities within these forms and these this language that was sort of never meant to function poetically. And sort of the surprise of how sound and meaning can be inferred by just the smallest increments of text. So that body of work sort of cycled through an interest in, I think, initially typographic form, exactly the way that you're describing, sort of an interest in the relationship of parts, the relationship of, you know, that we're often sort of compositional and, you know, the delicacy of a certain serif up against sort of the very structural letter form of something else, and just finding the poetry in that and finding a lot of interest in and in the associations that just those very basic design principles can bring. And then getting deeper into that work, it was a way for me to also navigate the city, because I had to find these signs somewhere. So especially when I moved from Cincinnati to St. Louis, it was kind of an impetus for me to get to know St. Louis. So I would drive around the city to different parts of the city and, you know, in my hunt for signage, but it was a way for me to get to know areas of the city that were having a lot of turnover, or, you know, I could find the signs in areas that were often sort of suffering from economically, because that was the areas where a lot of businesses were closing, or there was a lot of new signs for real estate that was. So it was a way to just be aware of those changes, and so I think that the documentation of place and of site became more important in the work, and that eventually, as I started noticing just the language and materiality of signs themselves shifting so much, initially I was finding these kind of interesting hand-painted signs sometimes, but...
Let me ask you about these signs, because that's so interesting that you're looking for the signs and the typography, and then there's the whole context of where you are, the neighborhoods you're going through, so the signs you were looking for... these are temporary signs, or you're just looking at kind of signage in general?
Well, I tried to, the signs that I would get, I would always, I would make sure that they were never being actively used. That was one of the parameters that I set for myself, is that the sign always had to be a sign that was sort of no longer functioning in the way that it was originally intended to. So in some cases that could mean it was a sign from a business that was now closing. I remember getting a sign from an antique store that was a family business for a really long time, and they were selling the family business, and so the sign was no longer of use for them. I actually tried to convince them that they should keep it, because I thought it might have some meaning for them, but to them it represented something in the past, or something that hadn't worked. So they sort of gladly gave me their sign. In other cases, the sign is temporary. I can always find temporary real estate signs. I mean, those seem to be the easiest to find. So signs that had sort of a short-term life, that were just there for the purposes of buying and selling property or land. So sometimes the nature of the signs just changed depending on the nature of the business or how long-term or temporary they were meant to be. But there were always wooden signs. I was sort of never interested in working with vinyl or metal. I think one of the reasons is that wood kind of had an integrity of material that I like. I come from a family of people that are very interested in woodworking, and so I have a lot of interest and respect for wood, and it carries weather and wear in, I think, a more interesting way sometimes than plastic. And I couldn't construct things as well in metal, so wood just seemed like a natural material for me to choose. So that was another one of the conditions or the parameters. And, as this body of work developed, it was harder and harder to find. It still is harder to find wooden signs because they're, as technology has just changed the materials that we use, from wood to plastic and now certainly to LED lights and things like that. Even the idea of a wood sign seems like a dated idea.
Mm.
So they're getting harder to find.
Yeah, I bet they are. That's true. And that, well, and also that they're hand-painted, right? I mean, I don't know if you're seeing less and less hand-painted signs, but all signs were hand-painted by a kind of an artisan who does just that or can be one of the things they do, right? It's a special craft, really.
Exactly, right. So there's sort of an interesting kind of history of visual culture and history of this craft and art of sign making that I can see just starting to disappear. Some of the older signs that I found initially, even back in Cincinnati, were some beautiful hand-painted signs. And I think that Cincinnati and St. Louis are similar in that way, that they have a manufacturing history, and there was a lot of wooden signs that advertised a lot of manufacturing around the city. I found some beautiful, beautiful old signs in both of those places that you could see the sign maker's hand very actively in that. And that has just been replaced by signs that are made cheaply and quickly. So the earlier work of mine had the subtleties and nuances that the original artist of the sign kind of brought to the table. So in a sense, there was a collaborative spirit going on even then, because I would look at what the sign maker had done and kind of respond to that. And it feels more and more sort of impersonal and generic when the signs that I'm finding now are mostly Helvetica font and mostly in, red and black and blue type. So that has just changed the look of my work too, which is probably one of the reasons that, I hit this a bit of a wall with that, even dealing with the same kinds of language that were square footage and telephone numbers and, hearing Stephanie's poems, the idea of working with language that was a little bit more interesting Sure. Probably seemed like a breath of fresh air. But I love the parameters of something that was never meant to be poetic and trying to think about ways that I could kind of instill that in it. So I think both ways of working with language, have something really interesting to offer.
And so you're continuing to make the paintings that you used to make and are exhibiting those as well?
Yeah, I have a gallery in Washington, D.C., Longview Gallery, and I tend to put most of that object-based work there. But I do some commission pieces. I've had an exhibition at the Bradford University 2 years ago, and that was really thinking about a fairly large gallery space. And it was just challenging for me to think about using those pieces of signage in slightly different ways. Like I build some freestanding towers that are, 8-9 feet tall. I ran a series of fragments of signs sort of along three walls in the gallery, so it became sort of like this flood of language, or almost like this dialogue of streaming text that sort of ran across the space. So I'm still using that material, and I'm still thinking those through and sort of adapting that in different ways. I think that the influence of technology has sort of shown up in the work, too. Like you said, the earlier work had a spirit of sort of the original, sort of the maker orientation in the signs themselves, if they were hand-painted or if they were sort of designed to be more thoughtfully composed. Now when I look at a lot of signage, there's a lot of streams of horizontal text, and there's a lot of technology glitches almost in it that deal with scrambled text and acronyms and things like that. So I think that thinking about the way that we use text now to communicate in shorthand and text messaging and streaming across billboards and across architectural facades of big buildings has changed the way that I'm responding to the signage and thinking that through a bit.
So interesting. It's been great talking to you. And before we go, I'd like to ask you the odd question that I always ask at the end, which is, what are you reading at the moment? Could be anything at all.
There's a couple of authors that I'm just sort of love right now. Anne Penchette is one of them. Ramona Ossebel is another one. I just finished Ramona Ossebel's collection of short stories called A Guide to Being Born just the other night. And I think she's got an incredible sense of lyrical imagery in the way that she uses language. You can tell that I'm sort of a lover of people who are able to sort of work with the craft of writing and really bring language to life in different ways. So she's someone that I'd really admire.
Cheryl, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.